You're listening to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience, a podcast dedicated to helping executives train their sales and marketing teams to optimize growth. Whether you're looking for techniques and strategies or tools and resources, you've come to the right place. Let's accelerate your growth in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, everyone, to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience. I'm Carlos Noche, and I'm joined by my always more popular than me podcast partner, Lisa Schneer. How are you, Lisa?
What an intro today, Carlos. I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
That was hours of creativity that I put into that. Today, folks, we got a little bit of a special episode. Today, we're talking about a topic that we all have struggled with. Why do some sales training initiatives, programs fail while others deliver amazing results? We've all been involved in sales training programs that start out with a big bang, but within weeks or months, they just kind of fizzle away and we don't see a measurable impact. You know, what causes these failed training programs? How do we ensure that we do have a measurable impact like Lisa and I and our guests today have seen in numerous accounts, avoiding some costly mistakes?
And to help us out with this very important topic today, we have PJ Nisbet, Managing Director of Nisbet Associates, a leading provider of the Value Selling Framework, and a business partner and very good friend of Carlos and I. PJ has had an outstanding career helping organizations grow and overachieve. His team has trained over 10,000 sales professionals in more than 40 countries. So he's well qualified to discuss this with us. PJ, thank you so much for taking the time today and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk about a subject which is close to all of our hearts, I think.
Very much so.
We are too. Now, before we get in there, to help our audience get to know you a little bit better, PJ, what is something that you're passionate about that those that only know you through work might be surprised to know about you?
Ah, that's an interesting question. So I don't think many people know that when I was growing up, my passion when we were growing up was that I was determined to be a professional show jumper. And my mother was absolutely convinced that I was going to be the next star of the bright lights and the show jumping equestrian arenas. As soon as I left school, I went off to work in the UK and I became an instructor. And that was my passion. And that's what I was going to do. It took me a few years to realize that actually that wasn't what I wanted to do. But that's what I grew up hoping that that's what I would be doing. And then I think I realized that actually, it's most successful equestrians actually end up running riding schools. And that wasn't what I had in mind for myself. So I went into business after that. But that was my goal. And not many people know that.
And it was mine. We've had a parallel childhood experience. But, you know, it's character building. So apart from our commonality with our love of horses, which carries on to this day, we just didn't make a career out of it. What else led you to where you are today? Tell us a little bit about the story as it picks up from deciding that wasn't the career for you.
So brief part of the history, I then went to university, studied industrial psychology. I joined Shell Oil in South Africa, which is where I was brought up. Spent 10 years with a big corporate, did the whole corporate through Shell. I think I had 6 different jobs in 10 years. Started selling, I think, when I was about 23 years old and been selling ever since. And then I joined a family business, completely different to Shell. We were in agricultural machinery and manufacturing. So we built a business over the next 10 years of selling agricultural parts and building plows and grass cutters and all sorts of things. And then I sold that. So I kind of did the chapter of the big corporate chapter of family business, bought my family out, sold it off, and then thought, what do I really want to do is help people with what I think is the most critical part of any business, which is to sell things. Because I think you can have great ideas, you can have great products, you can have great people, but at the end of the day, someone has to go out and get the order. And what I found as an entrepreneur was that was the most difficult thing. How do you go out and get the order? And of course, it's got harder, and of course, it's changed a lot. And that's why I decided to dedicate the last nearly 15 years now working in the area of sales performance improvement.
Well, PJ, I'm excited to have you on the podcast, brother. The topic we're talking about today is one that we all reminisce about over a pint. I've heard you call it the 7 deadly sins of sales training. And I love that, the way you kind of put it together. Really love to get your perspective on, I don't know if I want to look at it as why are some of the reasons programs fail, or should we look at it as, hey, what are some of the things you need to do to make sure it succeeds?
Yeah, exactly. Just a little bit of context before we jump into the seven deadly sins, as you say, and they're probably more than seven, but I can think of seven. They're kind of interesting statistics that you sort of alluded to at the beginning around how many of these interventions, these change initiatives fail. There's some very scary statistics out there. I think 8 out of 10 of these change programs fail, which is a pretty astronomical number, especially when you add to that the amount of money that is spent on sales training. I think the latest figures I saw, over $3 billion with a B dollars every year is spent on outside sales training providers in the world. So you've got this, like, all this money being spent, literally billions every year, and actually 80% of these interventions fail. They have zero behavior change. And I mean, that's just, for me, that's just like really a staggering statistic. So there's got to be something surely we can do better rather than wasting all this money.
Absolutely. Don't follow through and the program fails, you might as well just set that money on fire. It's one of those things that, you know, we go into it and the energy when you first do those workshops is so high. Everybody's bought in. Everybody's excited. So let's dive into then what happens next. Why does that excitement die off? What is missing? What do we need to reinforce?
And I think it probably starts with the planning for that intervention. So very important when people start to think about the first big area, which is not getting cross-functional alignment. So how do I involve the entire customer-facing role? So your pre-sales, your salespeople, obviously, your customer success, your solution consultants, sales enablement. So have you got a truly cross-functional approach? Because what tends to happen in organizations is you just take, we say we're going to train 14 salespeople, take them off, go somewhere nice, and nobody else knows what they're talking about. So we sell, and you both know this because we all do the same thing, it's not about selling training, it's about selling a true value transformation. In order to get that, you have to train across the entire organization to get the benefit of it. So what I see with many of our clients is if they really want to get the step change, and we know that if you don't have a methodology and then you put one in, you typically get, according to Gartner, between 15 to 20% increase in sales performance improvement. So if you don't have a framework or you don't have a common language, you can choose anyone, put it in and do it properly. There's a huge upside growth, but you only get that if you have got it across the board and the whole organization. That will be my number one, not getting the cross-functional alignment.
PJ, it's I'm almost laughing in my head because I was just having this conversation with a client that's worked with me twice before, Dale Knipp. He's a great guy. And he's at a new company. We're just talking about his last rollout. And he goes, Charles, I had some great success, but I also had some shortcomings. And one of the ones that their main product are selling these services projects. So he trained the sales side of the house, but not the services or delivery side of the house. Now the sales side is going to the services guys. Hey, this is how we roll this thing out. This is what we're doing. And instead of them feeling they were part of it, they felt like, oh, now sales is telling us how to deliver. And that's why I think this first one you hit is dead on. You know, everybody needs to feel like, hey, what role am I playing as part of this overall life cycle of the customer versus causing friction? So he was just telling me that, Charles, I thought it was a good thing. I was, you know, managing my budget. So I trained the sales guy, but I really kind of shot myself in the foot because I should have had the services guys right there with them because it's really two in a box that deliver this. One guy sells, let's say, a services contract. The other guy delivers on it, and they needed to be together. So I think I can't agree more on this one.
Yeah, 100%. And I would say I would particularly highlight the role of marketing. And again, we, you know, there are lots of scary statistics about the amount of marketing collateral that's actually wasted. I said that never gets used by salespeople, or the amount of time that salespeople spend looking for marketing assets before they can use it. So there are loads of statistics that, you know, the amount of money that's wasted by marketing producing stuff that is just like in another silo. So for me, part of that cross-functional alignment, and, you know, at the minimum you should do is involve your marketing folks in it as well. First prize is involve everybody who's involved right the way through the process. So that would be number one. Number two would be, and this one is fairly obvious, is getting that senior leadership buy-in. And I'm sure we've all had clients where had been led by sales enablement or HR, and you've got to go in at the back to say, can we please get the CRO involved? Can we get the CEO involved? Those are the examples that don't work very well. Where we've had successful clients is where it's really led from the top, where you've got, as we often do, a short video at the beginning of the course from the CEO or the CRO saying, this is really important. This is why we're doing it. And that's always a great question, because as we all know, very often with salespeople particularly, they're sitting in their workshop thinking, oh no, not another one. I've been on 15 sales courses already in the last couple of years. Here's another one. Why are we doing this? So you've got to have the why very clearly articulated from the top of the organization down. And that makes a huge difference.
I think that that is one of the things that also we have to maintain, because you'll get that senior leadership buy-in, especially if they're making quite a large investment. So to your point with the first point, if we are doing the entire revenue organization all the way through, that is a huge investment for the company. So the senior leadership seems very involved when they're like, okay, we're agreeing to spend this money. Then as time goes on, those messages from the top, they get fewer and fewer. And then next thing you know, it tapers just like the enthusiasm after a workshop tapers. So when you think about how we apply the value selling methodology, when we talk about power and maintaining power, what could you tell the listeners to help them to maintain a senior level relationship so that they don't taper off?
Yeah, that's such a good point. So it's about having regular check-ins. So I think it's, you know, it's about really having, depending on the level, quarterly or monthly management check-ins where we're looking at what are the deliverables we've agreed in terms of how you're going to measure leading and lagging indicators, this big investment that you're making. So what are the kinds of things we expected before and measure it early on. So you're not like doing the intervention and then say, oh, now let's see what's changed. Start tracking them at the beginning and then be very consistent to your point, Lisa, about, you know, let's check now every quarter what's happening, which of these leading and lagging indicators are changing so you can course correct if you need to. But it's about having the diligence and just keeping the regular contact with those senior people to say, hey, this is what's happening. This is what's going. This is what you've spent your money on. And I think that's crucial.
Absolutely. I think on the flip side too, PJ, is like, understanding from those senior people as you do your check-ins, what priorities might have cropped up in their world. So like, because of course we want to make sure that they're involved in this, but we also want to be checking in on that business issue, right? Like, so when we talk to those senior level people every month, every quarter, whatever that is, saying like, okay, what's your new focus or what's your current priority so that we can try to stay out in front of potential risk of the program becoming not such a priority.
Exactly. And what I found as well is that sometimes, and I'm sure you've had this experience also, sometimes those senior C-level sponsors don't actually know what we're doing. So they say, oh, so sales rep, managed selling, sounds great, let's do that. And actually, when you get the opportunity, and of course, you'll never get, or very unlikely to get them come and sit in a two-day program, although often they do, but more often they don't. But if you could spend a few minutes with them, and I've done this, you know, and I think back on successful clients, and just spend like 15 minutes with them saying, this is actually what we're teaching, just really quickly, look at this, look at that, look at that. And they're normally very, you know, clock speed is very quick, so they get it quickly. And then, okay, I see what you're doing. Okay, this sounds great. And that little bit of an investment in showing them like under the bonnet or under the hood, what exactly is it that you're teaching, I find makes a huge difference, because then it's real. It's not just like, oh, we're spending all this money on sales training. Actually, folks, this is what, I don't know if we can talk about value selling, but this is actually what a value prompter looks like. And there's like six boxes and open probe confirm questions. And it's, you're leading people through a value conversation. Oh, this makes complete sense. Everyone should do this. Well, exactly. That's what we're saying. So I think you have to take the time to explain to them.
Along those lines, thinking about successful implementations, one of the clients that we've had great success with, we actually started with executive alignment. So we took that concept and basically made the executive staff go through an abbreviated program. And at the end of it, it was, hey, what's your role in the rollout? And what was interesting about it is you had people, for example, in finance or legal go, hey, this is great. When they come to me for special terms, I'm going to ask them for that exact data so I can better assess, is this really a great opportunity for us or not? So if you start, I think, with this, you know, getting the executives aligned early, and make them take ownership of it. Then as you roll this thing out, it's not our program, it's their program. And then, we could follow through on the back end with those check-ins, because I think those are critical as well. Because Lisa's point, there's always something popping up. And sometimes just connecting the dots, right? Hey, I know this is the latest fire. This is how this relates to that. So that we need to keep the course here, or, tweak this a little bit to make sure we get those results you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, just not to belabor this one, but I think the other thing that I see often is like what I call the shiny toy syndrome. So they do it, and then maybe sales enablement change, or someone changes, or sales leader changes, and they say, oh, we're going to do some more training, bring in something else. And I mean, what I always say to folks is, it doesn't matter what you choose, just choose one and do it properly. You know, instead of going from one to the next, they often find like leadership changes and they say, oh, no, actually, I really like this one. So let's chuck that out and do something else. And everyone's going, oh, my goodness, not another thing that we have to be trained in. So just pick one. And I don't care which one you choose, but pick one and just do it properly, embed it, coach it, and don't confuse people with keep changing things. And I think that's one of the biggest wastes of money, that going back to that point, that there is because people jump too quickly. And it's just a shame, because it doesn't, you're not going to get a behavior change if you change your methodology every 2 years, which is kind of what a lot of people do.
Which is a perfect segue into number three, which you had as a lack of change management approach. Can you expand on that for the listeners?
Sure. And I mean, I think that's changing human behavior is one of the hardest things I think you can do. So you need to do a proper communication plan. You need to explain to people the why. That is crucial, that you spend the time at the start of every workshop explaining, and hopefully having those senior execs we were talking about explaining why are we doing this? Why is this important? So that you get away from, oh, we're just running another training course. There's a real business reason why we're all investing in our time and money in this major initiative. So I think it's about communication at the top, and we run the kind of why change, why now sessions. So everybody coming on the program, they get like a virtual session where they said, this is why we're doing it, normally with senior leaders chipping in there. And once you've communicated it, then it's about communication and really understanding the change management process and doing it step by step and explaining, over communicating if you have to.
And I think part of that too is aligning expectations, because I'm actually just doing a manager session to 25-ish. There's going to be like top level executives, but midline managers as well on Monday. And I was just looking at the deck and I was thinking, one of the biggest things is set the expectation. So what are you going to inspect after the training, and by when? So when we go through these sessions and we talk about our 30, 60, 90 day plans, we're trying to get people to commit to that over communication of, this is going to be what we expect from you post training, and this is how it's going to ramp up.
And I think also explain the why, maybe from the business point of view, but also what's in it for them, and again, that what's in it for me. But if I'm a tenured sales professional, and now I'm sitting in a 2-day class and I've got to do e-learning and post microlearning, the only way I'm going to change my behavior is if there's something in it for me. So you have to make, and part of that change management is, hey, this is going to make your life easier. You're going to close more deals. You might even get more commission. So really make it personal. If we go in there saying, this is another methodology, there's a whole lot of stuff you have to fill in the CRM, in my opinion, you're dead in the water before you start. They're going to say, no, more work, more CRM stuff, I'm not doing that. Whereas if we can go in and say, this is going to be really helpful to you to be more professional, I think you have a much better chance of success.
I'll ask both of you, have you seen incentives work as far as like incentivizing people who close their first deal with more than one value prompter, or like, are actually using the tools and communicating to the broader group that they had wins with the tools? Have you seen incentives behind that work?
Sure. Both in terms of like leading indicators, like the conversational tools, like the value prompter or the mutual success plan. So those things where we're saying the best one gets a nice weekend with their partner off to some exotic location, and you have a little internal competition. So gamification based on quality, not only quantity. And then I think in a more substantial way, I've got a client right now who is measuring what's called self-generated revenue. So these are opportunities that come from really good questioning where they're finding something else that rather than what the client phoned them about or spoke to them about. So if you ask really good questions and you're able to make a much bigger solution, self-generated, they can measure that and then they're compensated on that. So I think that there are a couple of things, you know, compensation, but also the typical kind of, obviously you need to get them using the tools, get the quantity right, but then also I think it's quality. And quality, I think you can definitely reward in a positive way, catch people doing things right.
You know, along those same lines, something I've done in a number of accounts is they've done a weekly or biweekly win call. And they like to do it usually on Mondays to kind of start the week on an upbeat. So they would have, hey, we're going to, as part of our, you know, Monday staff call, one rep, they show their prompter, they show their mutual plan, and they talk about how it worked within their account. And it's kind of one of those, nothing helps success more than success, right? Because when you start seeing your coworker use an aspect of the framework, see success with it, they're like, hey, I could do that too. And it starts this kind of snowball effect going into it. Now, PJ, this fourth one, to me, I remind clients, it's like my number one reason I think programs go awry. And you had it as a lack of coaching from those frontline managers. And I'll have you elaborate on it, but I'll share with you the story because I just did this workshop about a week ago. They rolled out something 2 years ago and their head of operations was saying, hey, guys, you know, we did this 2 years ago. Why didn't it work? And I go, but did you hold them accountable? Well, you know, and an example I use, I go, you tell your kids that their bedtime's 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. Do you just let the kid decide? Or the first time 9 o'clock came around, did you go, hey, it's bedtime, let's go. And one of the managers goes, best idea, tell them their bedtime and stick to it. So what do you mean by lack of coaching for frontline managers?
As you identified, Carlos, this is the real, I would say, silver bullet of the behavior change is that frontline sales management commitment. Data, the research is very compelling. If you spend 3 to 4 hours a month coaching your team or one-on-one coaching, you're getting a 15 to 20% improvement in sales performance. So, and maybe the 3 to 4 hours per month is nirvana. That's kind of a lot, but maybe even if you do half of that, if you had like 2 hours, which is like 30 minutes a week in a coaching conversation, not having like, coaching is like a deal review. So are you going to close this opportunity this quarter? But true coaching in that you're saying, you know, what's working well, what's not working well, what can I help you with? Being quite specific in that and going down a little bit deeper from those general questions, but what are the particular skills that you need to do in order to help you achieve your targets? So proper coaching conversation. And as I say, the evidence is overwhelming. If you spend the time doing that, there's a huge impact on performance. Now, the problem, of course, is that sales managers live in, to quote the Covey or the Eisenhower matrix, they're in quadrant one, urgent and important. There's always a fire that's been put out. There's a deal to be closed. There's a tender that they have to check because it goes in at 5 o'clock tonight. So they live in that world of urgent and important. And now you're saying it's really important to do weekly coaching conversations. And very often just doesn't happen. The one thing that gets bumped out of their schedule. And then they're not doing that. And as we all know, that is the single most effective way to get a return on investment from the training investment. I mean, I think the figures are you get an 80% better return on a training spend if you coach it. And if you don't, guess what? Everybody's going to forget it. And again, scary statistics, 80% is lost within 30 days. So if you just run a two-day workshop and then do nothing, most of it is gone pretty quick.
Lisa, goes back to your point about inspection. If you just have them go through the training and do nothing afterwards, you're basically saying, hey, it's up to you. It's all optional. Pick and choose what you like. I think another big challenge that I see with managers is they confuse managing and coaching. When you're managing towards a number, and as soon as you tell the, you know, the rep comes to you, goes, hey, I got this deal. You know, I'm working on this. I'm struggling. Yeah. Is it coming in or not? Is it a commit? Or is it an upside? And all we're doing is managing a number. What we're telling them is we don't care about the rest of this. And we're not really coaching them to get better. We're just managing towards a number. And that's the difference of we get trapped in that sometimes. We got to make a conscious effort to help our reps develop and become better. And what I try to remind folks is when you get a good manager that does coach you and make you better, you probably will work for them forever. you get low turnover because they're making you better than you are. But when you get someone that just manages to your number, yeah, you're rolling the flip because there's no real assistance or partnership from that manager in your daily life.
Yeah, and particularly with the newer workforce coming in to the workplace now, it's even more important. You know, young people are now, for them, coaching is so important. They stay with employers because they're feeling developed. Much more, certainly in my day as a boomer, it wasn't that important. You got close, you were lucky. But now, I think when I talk to my I got four children and they're all like in their 30s going on, nearly the oldest one's nearly 40. But for them, they need to be developed. It's the number one thing with the companies that they're in. And I don't think they're unusual in that. So that coaching piece is critical. It's not about the training. I mean, the training is everyone will have fun and you know, we can have a great time in 2 days. It's absolutely about the coaching. And it's so obvious, and yet people don't do it. I think it's, you know, it's the biggest failing. If you ask me which one of the seven would be my most deadly, it's that lack of coaching and people just not doing it. And I understand why. It's about prioritization and it's about time management, but then it's about the quality of the coaching conversation and not getting sucked in. I mean, I had that actually this morning or yesterday afternoon. I was talking to someone and they were saying, oh, we've got this really nice coaching app and we go in, but it's a little bit clunky and I tried it and actually I'm quite good at this. And I find there's coaching conversations all the time when I go around with people. I'm not sure that's a coaching conversation. So it's not that easy. Most sales managers struggle with this piece.
I was just looking at this morning, so I have it open, but just a couple of stats from the Sales Executive Council around that. Salespeople who receive as little as 3 hours of coaching per month perform 15 to 17% better than their peers. Organizations that combine training and coaching to improve productivity will see productivity rise up to 88% versus training alone. Sales organizations that significantly improve their coaching programs realize a 19% increase in revenue at a minimum. So backing up the importance of coaching, not only, like, I agree with you, PJ, I know a number of people who have left companies because they felt like they weren't being developed. And it was no other reason. They had no problem with the company, the product, the management team. It was just they felt like they hit a wall. And if you're not being developed and you're not staying interested and feeling like you're challenged, then why would you carry on like that? Now, not everybody is like that, of course. But as you can hear from those stats, it's not only good for the person and retention, it's good for the organization. Yeah, very important. And then, so coaching, very important. But going back to something we were talking about earlier, which is important for us also to show the return on their investment, is measuring. So this discussion, it happens all the time. And sometimes we're challenged by whatever the internal tech stack is. But when we set up the initial conversations, we try to get them to commit to what are the key points we're going to measure. And so when that happens and you see that people are measuring the wrong things, PJ, like what are the mistakes that they're making?
I'm sure you've had the same experiences as I have, that very often people, they use overly complicated metrics. So they say something like, oh, I really want to improve my velocity. So then when you dig a little bit deeper and say, so what does that actually mean? I want to reduce my sales cycle. Okay, that's good. What is that? Is that from lead to opportunity? Is it from quote to proposal? Is it from proposal to close? So let's talk about that. Oh, well, actually, everybody waits so they don't put anything in the CRM until they've got the quotation ready, and then they put in the quotation and then they close it. So when you dig into a lot of these things, I find that it's not clear to them even. So for me, I always say to them, let's just try and find two or three. And I think things like revenue are too broad. And I'm sure you've also had the experience where people say, oh, let's do revenue. But that wasn't because of the sales methodology that it improved. That was because we bought another company or the market changed or something like that. So I think you've got to go deeper than just revenue. And I think you've got to be very specific and find things that they can easily measure, like from an inbound lead, so lead to proposal, or whatever it might be, whatever they can lead. I encourage my clients not to have too many. As I say, just let's get two or three that we know you can measure reliably, that we've got a track record for, hopefully 12 months before, and that we can monitor every month and really check that we're getting a sea change in those simple metrics. And don't overcomplicate it, because you know that's I think, the shiny toy syndrome. People come up with all sorts of weird and wonderful you know, performance measures, keep it simple and make sure you can measure it and share it with us, by the way, because sometimes we've got this metric, but actually we can't share that with you. Well, then there's no point. It's not worth doing it.
And your point there, this happens all the time when somebody says, okay, we want to increase our average sale price or we want to increase our sales velocity. And you say, okay, so what is it today? And they can't answer that question. It's like, okay, if we don't have a benchmark to start with, then what is success actually looking like here? So they have to go and find that data. So I highly encourage anyone who's investing in this, get the benchmarks in place now, and then be confident that that data is at least, you know, 90% correct. I know that there's a lot of challenges with data not being 100% correct. And that's, I don't know that that's ever going to go away. But yeah, as long as you can come and give us some benchmarks, tell us what kind of increase would you consider success? And then we'll go from there, because it's just like, if we're flying blind, that, oh, any increase is better. That's okay. Well, then how are we going to tie that back to any hard numbers and show you that you did well and that the training was worth it and that it's working? So I think you kind of combined 5 and 6 there, because we had not measuring what matters was number 5. Number 6 was overall too complex an approach. So obviously complex in what we're measuring, but is there other things that you feel are that they focus on that are much too complex?
Yeah. And I think, again, that's what I often see. So it's not only the measurement, but it's actually the methodology. It's typically what happens, and I'm sure you've seen this many times. They put in a methodology and then someone says, oh, you know what? It's missing this part. So I'm going to make this extra little box, or I'm going to do this. So what happens is people fiddle, and it does not take long before it's so confusing that nobody knows what's going on. And I see it all the time. You go back into the client, you put in a simple, I mean, the big differentiator of value selling, as you know, is a simplicity. It's a kind of elegant simplicity that works because it's instinctive and intuitive. And what happens is we do that, we go back in and then we find, oh, look what's happened. There's all these other things that are like tacked on, and people are saying, oh, it's really important to do like white space analysis in the middle of all of this. And the poor old sales professionals are sitting there saying, what? Simple. Now we've got all these other things we have to think about. So what I mean by the 6th deadly sin is do not overcomplicate it. You know, it works because it's simple. There has to be an advantage for the salesperson to use a framework. And the moment you start to overcomplicate it, and there are many wonderful methodologies in the world, but most of them, in my opinion, are too complicated for people to use. They just like, this is too much of a heavy lift. It's great. It sounds very nice, but actually I can't ever see myself using it.
I'm laughing because 2 recent prospects I talked to, they're like, well, do you have anything in place today? Yeah, we have the AOP, XOT, LOS, NOB. I'm like, the what? I mean, did you guys just pick letters? And I go, does anybody even remember that? No, Carlos, we end up just calling it PVX or XY. Does anybody even know what the letters stand for? And I think going back to the simplicity thing, sometimes we look at it just from our perspective, like you need these 37 things in the deal. I think one of the things that value selling is that make it simple is we look at it from a buyer's process. And we say, hey, this is what the buyer needs to make a deal. Why don't we make it the same for us? And it sounds so simplistic at the heart of it, but in 15 plus years of doing this and then using different programs before this, it is part of the magic sauce of getting it to stick. If you can't explain it on a napkin in a bar, it's probably too complex. And if the buyer has no interest in hearing it whatsoever, then why are we using it as our way of measuring sales? All right, I know we're going to run out of time, so let's get this number 7 out. What's your number 7 deadly sin?
So it's not baking it into the sales DNA, into the technology. So we talked about the coaching piece. Of course, that's important. But the other one to really get the behavior change is that you spend the time to think about what are we doing daily, weekly, monthly, and how are we going to use this common language to bake into those processes? How are we going to bake it into our underpinning technology like the CRM? So that when people finish the training, it's like the first deal review they go to, the first one-on-one they go to, the first time they go into the CRM, there is the common language that we've spent all the time talking about. And I think if you, your chances, again, of behavior change, if you don't do that, I think are quite limited, because it'll just be another little training course and we go off back to exactly what we were doing before. So a real sign of commitment is let's bake it into whatever we do. And the language is there for everybody to see.
This is one of my pet peeves, and it actually kind of relates back to your number 1 in a way about other parts of the organization not being on board with you. And the reason I call it a pet peeve is I sit down with a rep after a workshop, having a pint, and you go, Carlos, you don't understand. Our CRM's a mess. Our sales stages don't map to this. Our forecasting calls have a whole other process. I got to fill up this other paperwork to hand it off to our services guys. Marketing's giving material. It has nothing to do with this new sales program that we're doing. And I got to do an executive summary to get an executive commit, which is a whole other form. Yeah, I'm like, well, when do you, you're filling out all these forms. When do you have time to sell? He goes, I don't. So we talked about simplicity before this. Look at the processes that we got going on in the organizations, from your QBRs to your forecasting to your systems, and streamline it. Make it all part of your sales DNA. I couldn't agree more. Lisa, have you seen stuff like that as well?
Yeah, actually, I was just talking about this again for a client is, baking it into their CRM and having reportable fields so that they can measure, but also baking it into the exit criteria on their sales stages. So, you know, you don't have to go all in, like you say, PJ, simplistic at first. We've got deals, any deal over $150,000 has to have certain criteria, you know, so we're tracking that first before it gets baked into every sales stage, every opportunity. But then also another thing that I guess, again, sounds super simple, but is challenging is you've got to really decide where are these tools going to live. So if you've got a content management system, you got like a Seismic or a HighSpot or whatever, or you're using Teams, or I don't really care where it is, but you've got to decide where can people go to find what they need in order to deliver what you're asking them to deliver. Because if they're living in multiple different files in multiple different places. I mean, we hear it every day. Oh, I couldn't find a blank value prompter. I couldn't find an example of this. I don't know where the plan letter templates are. I don't know where the OATs are. So, you know, like you've got to have a sales enablement or sales effectiveness person to help with, okay, this is the folder. This is where you go. And that way, when we're conducting the workshops and any follow-up from that, it's go to this folder, go to this, you know, wherever this repository is that saves all these documents, which, like I say, sounds super simple. But at the same time, we see it all the time where it lives in multiple different places and people are pulling it from multiple different places. And that's not helpful. Ideally, your organization can access and view all of those materials, whether they're completed or not, and learn from them.
Yeah, exactly. And you get these little power struggles between like sales enablement, say we're going to keep all the tools here. And IT says, no, no, you can't do that. You got to keep them over here. And the poor old salesperson is just saying, give me a value prompt. I don't care where you keep it.
Exactly. We typically ask a couple of different questions at the end of a podcast, but one that I think everybody will find kind of interesting from your personal or business perspective, is there a misstep or mistake you've made in your career or personal life that you learned something valuable from that our listeners might also be able to learn from?
It's a really great question. And I think it's probably, if you only had one misstep, I think I would say we should be learning all the time. And I think life is about learning. And I think you have to keep learning. So I would say there are lots of missteps, first of all. But I think if I think about how to apply it to this area, I would say, early on in my selling career, and in fact, I'm thinking now about in the sales performance improvement area, I was not flexible enough. So my message to the listeners were, we all talk about the importance of listening, but I think you have to be really flexible. I think particularly when you start out, you're saying, look, I'm the expert. I know what to do. We've done this many times. You should do it this way. Often, and my learning was that I've lost really big deals because I wasn't flexible enough, because I said, well, that'll never work. You can't do it like this because it just won't work. And actually then they said, all right, well, we'll do it on our own then. And guess what? It did work. So for me, the learning is you have to truly listen and truly be flexible, because it's about being a bit humble, I think. And I think there's a danger as you've done. I mean, I've done this for nearly, I don't know, 15 years or something crazy, much longer than I thought I would do it for. But I think if I've learned anything is that you have to be really, really flexible. It's not about saying, this is what works. I mean, what we've been talking about the last half hour or so is not rocket science. It's very simple steps. I always say to people, I don't know how to make this complicated. It's like really simple. But sometimes they say, we want you to do it. We want to do it. And I think you've got to be flexible enough to say, well, yeah, we can do that. We can help you out. So that would be my big learning, would be humbly curious and don't be too stuck on what your kind of paradigm is about this is what works, because often it can work another way.
That's great advice. And I think, yeah, we used to say, don't get too precious about the process and leave your egos at the door, folks. So PJ, amazing, amazing advice here. And if a listener was interested in getting in touch with you to discuss this more or to potentially hire you, what's your preferred method that they get in touch with you?
Just to go on the Value Selling website, look me up. My email address is pjnisbet@valueselling.com. And yeah, that's the best way to reach out.
Fantastic. Cannot thank you enough for taking the time today. We know how valuable it is, and it's been great having you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, PJ.
All right, everyone, that does it for this episode. Please check us out at www.b2brevexec.com. Share this episode with your friends, your family, your dogs, your kids. Get them off screens for a little while. You can subscribe through YouTube, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. And if you like what you hear, you can do us a huge favor and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. I am Lisa Schneer, and I am joined by my always charming podcast partner, Carlos Noche. And until next time, we wish you nothing but the greatest success.
You've been listening to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.